Good evening. My name is Nick Stern. I'm the IG Patel Professor of Economics and Government at the London School of Economics. It's an enormous privilege for us to have with us this evening Tharman Shanmugaratnam. You all know who he is because that's why you're here, but nevertheless, I'll just say one or two words. He is the Deputy Prime Minister of Singapore, the Chair of the Monetary Authority. He has recently been, for a very important period, the Chair of the committee, the IMFC, which essentially runs the IMF, the committee which basically the Managing Director of the IMF is ultimately responsible to through the board of the IMF. He is the chair of the Group of 30, which is a self-elected group of wise people, but they are wise, who think about the world of finance, but they are wise and they are important. Most importantly, of course, he's a graduate of the London School of Economics, in economics, and in our wisdom, we were very honoured that he accepted. We made him an honorary fellow in 2011. And just as important, his wife, Jane Itogi, is also a lawyer and a graduate of the, very distinguished lawyer, and a graduate of the London School of Economics as well. So, Jane and Tharman, you're enormously welcome. We're greatly honoured that you've come to talk to us today. The world needs your wisdom and experience always, but particularly now, and your commitment not only to fundamental values, but also to reason and to evidence are also particularly important now. So thank you so much for coming and joining us this evening, and we look forward very much to hearing what you have to say, and that reminds me to ask all of you to turn off your mobile phones. But Tharman, it's a great privilege to have you with us back at the London School of Economics. We're very proud of our alumni and particularly of you. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Nick. Thank you for inviting me. And thank you for the generous introduction. Carefully sequenced in ascending order of importance of my credentials. So the fact that I studied at the LSE came towards the end. And it's good to be back. Vastly better facilities than we used to have. And you, of course, you ended up by talking about Jane. And I wouldn't have gotten married to Jane if I wasn't at the LSE. So the topic that I'm speaking on is really something at the heart of the challenges we face in government and in society almost everywhere. It's often talked about as an advanced country problem, but it's really a global problem. We're in a world that's getting used to political surprises. But these are surprises that are laid on a sequence of events that has been taking place over decades. They are not surprises when we look at what they come, when we look at the undertow that's been taking place in economy, in society. Economic undertow, an undertow in society, the growing of rifts in society. We know the basic economic facts. There is stagnation of middle-class incomes in much of the advanced world, and a rise in joblessness, particularly amongst the young. An alarming proportion of young people in Europe, especially, are now on the outside looking in. And even the United States, which has seen the best recovery from the global financial crisis, there's been a significant dropout of people from the labor force. So although the unemployment rates look a little lower, it masks the fact that people have been dropping out. The emerging world, which is often viewed quite rightly as a place where there's more rapid growth, incomes are rising, including for the middle class, that too masks the fact that we haven't seen the convergence of living standards between the emerging world and the developed world that was expected 3 or 4 decades ago, expected by economists, expected by people who just generally felt that if you're starting from a lower level, participating in the world economy, opening yourself up to technology, will allow you to catch up. It did happen for 4 small Asian countries called the newly industrializing countries from the 60s onwards, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong. It then happened in a major way in China. China was and is a successful example of convergence, starting from very low levels of income, low levels of productivity and income. In fact, in 1980, China had about 1/40th the level of productivity, average productivity, of the United States. And it's today, 35 years later, at 1/4 the level of the United States, from 1/40th, or about 2.5%, to 1/4, or 25%, in 35 years. A remarkable achievement. But outside of China, which followed the NIEs, convergence has been the exception rather than the rule. We've had some convergence taking place in India and the ASEAN countries in Southeast Asia, but again, much less than expected. India started off in 1980 with twice the level of productivity of China. It now has half the level of productivity of China. Latin America, without exception, has the same level of productivity today relative to the United States, the same gap in productivity levels, and therefore average income levels, that it used to have in the 60s, let alone the 1980s. No convergence has taken place in Latin America. Likewise for Central Europe and Central Asia. Virtually no convergence, with the exception of 1 or 2 countries, with Poland being a major example. Turkey, too, did relatively well until the 2000s, and then since then, you've had little convergence. So the convergence story, which is so basic to development economics, just hasn't played out. Just hasn't played out. That's what I've spoken about so far, is about absolute growth of incomes underpinned by the absolute growth of productivity. But the other trend, and a profound one, has been in social mobility. Social mobility has slowed in much of the advanced world and is now at a rather low level. So where you start off in life determines to a great extent where you end up in life. In the US, today's mid-30s individuals, people in their mid-30s, you'll find that half of them have lower incomes than their parents did in their generation in their mid-30s. In other words, at the same age, their parents had higher incomes than them. That's a remarkable development. Because if you go back to 1980, 90% of the 30-year-olds had higher incomes than their parents. And that was the norm in the post-war period. Incomes went up, children had much better education, much better jobs, and much better incomes than their parents. Today it's half-half. And if you look at the industrial Midwest, which is where the vote swung in the last elections, it's less than half. Less than half of those in the mid-30s have incomes exceeding what their parents had at the same age. So going backward is now the norm. That's absolute mobility, where people are compared to where their parents were. But relative mobility in society is also extremely important. The reshuffling that takes place within each generation, so that where you start off, where you're born, doesn't determine where you end up in life. And that relative social mobility, or that fluidity in society, has always been extremely important in preserving a sense of fairness. And that too is stubbornly low. And it's low not just in places like the US and UK, but even in societies which we know to be more egalitarian, like the Scandinavian societies. Social mobility is in fact much lower than often thought to be. They've got very strong redistributive states, but social mobility, as reflected in the jobs and incomes you earn, has been low. Where you start off in life has a big influence on where you end up by the time you're in your 30s, 40s, and beyond. And in the emerging world, social mobility has always been a problem, more so in societies with underdeveloped education systems, like India, Africa, Latin America. It was a problem, still a problem. So that combination of a slowdown in income growth with the stubbornness of low levels of social mobility is a potent combination. It gives people the sense that the system isn't fair. That's the basic picture of mobility. But something else has been happening, which is a erosion of the sense of togetherness in society. In the advanced world, if you think back to what it was like in the 50s and early 60s, there was a prevalent sense of we. It was like that in the US, like that in Europe, recovering after the war. There was a sense of we. Now it is increasingly them and us. And it's no longer the convenient divisions by economic class, which now looks stable in comparison to what we see today. It's now a whole multitude of divisions. Rural against urban, less educated against more educated, conservative in social values versus cosmopolitan. It's a state of agitation. And it's a state of agitation that leaves the field prime for populist politics. That loss of a sense of togetherness is compounded by the fact that multiculturalism, in its traditional forms, hasn't worked out well. It hasn't worked out well in the societies which took a passive attitude towards multiculturalism. Let in immigrants, let minorities settle where they will. And you assume that somehow people would get more used to each other over time. They would feel more alike, and they would share the same aspirations. And it just hasn't worked out that way. And unexpectedly, a second generation of immigrants, the children of those who first came into these societies, feels more alienated than the first generation. You see it everywhere. Antwerp, Marseille, Leicester. That surprising outcome, that the second generation feels more alienated than the first generation did. Feels more excluded in school, in the labor market, and in society. And that is now greatly complicated everywhere in the world, advanced and developing, by the fact that religious strife has been globalized. What happens in one part of the world is something that happens everywhere. Religious strife is globalized, and it greatly complicates how we manage multiculturalism and let it survive, and let it be a basis for sustainable democracies. Thirdly, we've also seen a loss of trust in traditional politics and in government, and in particular, a weakening of the center in politics. For a long period, there was a center left, there was a center right. They alternated, typically in Europe, in the UK, and the US, but it was the political center. And there's been a weakening of trust in the center. And more perniciously, we now have a situation where the parties of the center are chasing the shadows of the populist extremes in order to stay alive in politics. It's not new, this decline in trust. It's been happening over a long period of time. It's not a product of the last year. Political scientists trace the loss of trust in government in the US back to the 1960s. That's when the major decline in trust took place, during what was called the Culture Wars. But it's now a new fact of life, this lack of faith in traditional politics and the politics of the center. And voter apathy is an expression of that. I mean, the remarkable fact of the last US elections was the fact that 45% of people didn't vote. The vote in Brexit was higher, but amongst the young, it was relatively low. These were not inconsequential issues that people were voting on. They were voting on real choices for their countries. Why the voter apathy? There has been a loss of trust in politics, and it has to be redressed. And as an overlay on these trends in all our societies, we're now seeing a transition to a multipolar world. That is not going to be a smooth transition. You don't immediately reset to a new equilibrium. It's something that is going to take place over a couple of decades, with contest all along the way and uncertainty all along the way. That's inevitable because the center of gravity of the world economy has shifted and the power balance is shifting. And that's an overlay on top of these domestic trends that we've seen. So it's no surprise that all this leads to political surprises. And the real question we have to ask ourselves isn't just about the politics of who gets elected, but what do we do about the underlying trends? What do we do about the undertow? And we have to be clear about the causes of this undertow, be it in wages, social mobility, and so on. Technology accounts for the bulk of job losses that we've seen in manufacturing. All the studies show that. Globalization, which is an easier target than technology because it's not an easy narrative to criticize the robots or artificial intelligence. Much easier to criticize someone who took away your job from abroad. But globalization, from all the studies, accounts for no more than 20% of the loss in manufacturing. And a fair bit of the jobs lost in manufacturing were actually recreated outside manufacturing. So globalization is a factor, and you can't quite disentangle it from technology, but it's a relatively small factor compared to technology. But the really big story is not about technology and globalization. The really big story is about domestic policies, domestic policy responses to technology and globalization. That's the real differentiator between countries. And the use and abuse of domestic policy is the inconvenient fact of globalization. There's a reason why Sweden has done better than the UK, the US, much of the European Union. Median incomes, even the incomes of those lower down in the income ladder, have continued to grow, even in the last decade in Sweden. There's a reason why amongst the more developed Asian countries, Singapore has done relatively well as well, both for the median and the workers lower down on the ladder. There's a reason why the proportion of NEETs, not in employment, education or training, amongst young people, is much lower in Switzerland, Japan, Germany, the Scandinavian countries, or Singapore, compared to other countries. It's not that these are countries that are less globalized or less exposed to technology. In fact, by and large, these are smaller societies that are more exposed to globalization and more exposed to technological change. But domestic policies are what differentiate countries. And domestic policies, not just at the national level, but at the local level, in cities and towns. There's a reason why in Italy, Milan is doing well, still vibrant, and Mezzogiorno in the south is languishing. There's a reason why in Germany, Stuttgart and the towns around it, in Baden-Württemberg, are thriving, moving towards Industry 4.0, whilst Bremen and parts of the Ruhr Valley are languishing. There's a reason why Pittsburgh had a rebirth and Detroit didn't. And there's a reason why in France, Lyon has revitalized itself and become a digital hub, whereas Lorraine is still languishing. There's a reason why in emerging countries you have wide disparities between cities. Local policy, local compacts, local coalitions matter too. So where do we go from here? First, I think we have to recognize that the status quo strategies of the right and the left will not bring inclusive growth back and will not bring back a sense of togetherness in society. Market fundamentalism has failed. Left to the market, problems are not only stubborn, they tend to multiply. We now know that. The economists have explanations for this. Once people lose out in employment and they stay out of the workforce, if they don't get a job quickly, hysteresis sets in. Actually came from physics, and the economists borrowed it to sound that they're a bit more rigorous. But it's real. Once you're out of the workforce, you lose your skills, and employers feel you've lost your skills. It's hard to get back in. But important too, it's not just about economic markets, it's about the social market. Left to the market, the advantages and disadvantages that we all start off with tend to multiply, not get lesser. And the invisible hand of social culture is as powerful as the invisible hand of the market. Problems multiply rather than get erased. In financial markets, analysts always think in terms of reversion to the mean. Stock is overvalued, or financial instrument has a price that's overvalued. After a while, there's reversion to the mean. The market equilibrates. There's no reversion to the mean in society. Problems multiply, disadvantages get larger if you leave it to the market. And people tend to segregate over time. That's a lesson we learn from evidence, not from prior belief, but from evidence. Market fundamentalism is not going to bring back inclusive growth or a sense of togetherness. But likewise, the traditional strategies of the left aren't going to bring it back either. Traditional social democracy, which is what has characterized the center-left in Europe and in the advanced world, is tired, and it's not going to be able to rekindle hope amongst people. That social democratic model has evolved in the last few decades in the direction of redistribution as a means of mitigating the inequalities of the market. And it's heavily focused on redistribution. It hasn't helped very much in broadening opportunities before the redistributive state kicks in. And we need new strategies and a new ethos in politics, both because of this failure of market fundamentalism as well as the growing irrelevance of the old social democracy. We need new strategies to bring back hope and to revitalize the politics of the broad center. We need a new ambition of the state, but focused on a few critical objectives. First, fostering social mobility and opportunities for all. In other words, enabling people to earn their own success. Second, regenerating individuals, neighborhoods, and towns. Not just redistributing. Regeneration, not just redistribution. And third, integrating people, particularly in multi-ethnic societies. And moving away from the illusion that simply having people live in the same towns or societies will lead to more sameness over time. That passive multiculturalism has failed, and we need a more active multiculturalism, accommodating people actively, thickening the relationships between them, building friendships through life, but ensuring that we've got guardrails in society to ensure that multiculturalism can be sustained in a democratic setting. And in all of this, we need the state to work in partnership with civil society, with educational institutions, with business enterprises and chambers, with the unions, and even with the groups of individuals in the gig economy. New partnerships focused on social mobility, focused on regeneration, and focused on integrating people. And I will go through briefly four key strategies to achieve these objectives. Education, so as to enable everyone to earn their own success, and to develop a broader and more fluid meritocracy. Second, innovation and quality jobs, often seen as a contradiction with each other, because innovation and technology is seen as removing jobs or destroying jobs, but it need not be. With the right strategies, innovation and quality jobs go hand in hand together. Third, staying open to the world for reasons that are quite different from the issue of whether there's enough demand in the world, and I'll come to that later. And fourth, the criticality of housing and neighborhoods, something that economists don't focus on too much, but something that is now a very salient differentiator between societies. Education. We know we have to intervene earlier in a child's life to reduce the deficits that people can be born with, to ameliorate the lottery of birth, as they call it. James Heckman's work is persuasive on the long-term benefits of early interventions, not just for cognitive skills, but also for the non-cognitive skills that are required to do well in life, in the job market, in society, and in bringing up families. And all over the world, the advanced countries and the developing countries, we have to focus on this area of public policy, early interventions. Without the convenience of schools, which are very convenient institutions, but having to work in communities, having to work in families, and doing it in a way that's not so intrusive and doesn't remove the dignity that parents want to have in bringing up their children. But we have to intervene more actively, to reduce the lottery, to reduce, ameliorate the deficits that one can be born with. And there are good examples of this in the advanced world. There are good examples in places like India, where prenatal interventions, interventions at childbirth, interventions with mother and child especially, are having results. I found one example in Madhya Pradesh, where just in a matter of 5 years, the percentage as a result of these interventions with mother and child, they call it mother and child centers or Anganwadis, the percentage of underweight children came down from 60% to 48%, still very high. About half of each cohort is underweight. And stuntedness is a very serious problem that stunts you through life. But impressive results within a short space of time. These are things that can be done, and they require public policy initiative, they require partnerships, and they require politicians to be held accountable for it. Second, schools, still critical. And here I think there's an important tension that we have to accept between differentiation and uniformity. Every system has to accept this tension. There's a debate taking place in the UK, I know. The government has issued a green paper on its school system with the intention of introducing more diversity in the state school sector, giving a bit more of a role to grammar schools, very sensitive and emotional topic, giving more of a role to the academies, giving more of a role to state schools that want to develop excellence and allowing for greater degree of selection. All sensitive topics, but if we take a step back and look at the way things have played out, one of the central facts in education is that strategies that are focused on the form of egalitarianism, which is that everyone studies the same thing at the same pace and the same curriculum in every school, those egalitarian forms have tended to have very inegalitarian outcomes. It looks good while it lasts, but come the time when people leave school, very inegalitarian. Too large a proportion of students drop out or leave school with nothing in their hands. Not a good strategy for equity. Too much differentiation, especially if it's too early, is also risky. It tends to create, in the nature of things, it just creates a sense of elitism, not necessarily social elitism, but meritocratic elitism. So we've got to be careful about that balance between differentiation and uniformity. But we must be willing to differentiate so that education can be tailored to each child's starting abilities, deficits that need to be closed, and the ability to follow a pace of learning that they find comfortable. We have to be willing to do that. In Switzerland, at age 15, 70% of kids go down a vocational path. It's the norm. In Germany, it's 40%. In Singapore, at age 13, we differentiate kids, not according to a vocational path per se, but different paces of learning. And in the early days, I think we went about it in a somewhat too rigid a way. We've now made it more flexible, more fluid, and there's still some way to go. But it's an example of just accepting the fact that if you want to develop everyone's potential, you need some customization. It's fairer to them, and they leave school with something real in their heads and a certain self-confidence that they can go on in life. But second, quite apart from structures, differentiation, what age you do it, what proportion go through a vocational stream versus an academic stream, the overwhelming fact that differentiates education systems, and this is true in the advanced and the emerging world, is simply the quality of the teaching force. That's why Finland and Singapore tend to be near the top end of the PISA scales, the PISA rankings. Quality of teachers, how you recruit, how you reward, how you develop teachers in their careers, how you provide, as Singapore does, how you provide school leaders with sabbaticals, how you promote based on performance. In every other area of enterprise, or even if you look at the university sector, you know, the U.S. is a classic case because the university sector is highly meritocratic. Tenureship, who gets promoted, etc., is highly meritocratic. But the school system is seniority-based. It's a relic, but it's a living relic. And it's unfair and inequitable. That's the biggest differentiator around countries. And in developing countries, this is still a central challenge of educational policy. Never mind curriculum, never mind pedagogical methods, just getting the right people into the teaching force, rewarding them well enough, developing in their careers, and in some countries, making sure they turn up at school. A very serious problem in places like India. Very serious problem. That's fundamental if you want to talk about social mobility. A third very important issue in education is the over-academization of tertiary education. There's been a both a deliberate and inadvertent move into a regular four-year academic college education almost across the world. It happened in the UK and the US. In the UK, it was a deliberate policy. Tony Blair wanted 50% of kids to go through university, and the polytechnics were converted into universities. It's happened in the US. It's happened in Europe now, which started with a very different tradition, but it's happening as well. And I'd say the Bologna agreement or arrangement aimed at uniformity across Europe and harmonization is also eroding the original applied and technical path in European tertiary education. India and China, oversupply of college grads, significant oversupply. So everywhere in the world, there's been this mindless trudging in the direction of an academic college education that is not suited to individual abilities and to maximizing abilities and not suited to the needs of even the most modern societies. And that's why in the United States, 45% of college students don't complete their course, and 45% of those who do complete it end up getting jobs that didn't require a college degree. Wasteful, both to family resources and state resources, but also inequitable. It's not the way to develop the potential of individuals. Some people are suited to it, but we've got to redress that bias and move towards a system where there's a better bridge between theoretical and real-world learning, between the academic and the applied, which maximizes most individuals' ability to learn and retain what they've learned, but also prepares them for the jobs of the future. And this is a bias across the advanced and emerging world that has to be redressed. That's education, and I've spoken at some length about it because it is the most fundamental economic and social strategy and is the most important way in which we can revitalize social mobility. But let me move on now to the whole issue of innovation and the quality of jobs. It's the stuff of magazine stories these days, whether technology is removing jobs. Technology is not destroying all jobs. Even in the US, which is where technology has proceeded furthest in the economy, there are really two stories of what's been happening. First, there's a story which economists tell very well, which is job polarization. Jobs are being created at the top, they're being created at the bottom, but the jobs in the middle are being eroded. But there's another story of the middle that's equally important. there are a very large number of jobs in the middle in the United States that are not being taken up because individuals do not have the skills that employers want, and employers are not investing in the skills that they need. There's a market failure. There's a mismatch of supply and demand. And that story in the middle is extremely important. There's no lack of middle-skilled, middle-income jobs in the United States today. And that's the society that has moved furthest in the introduction of technologies in the workplace. Robots and artificial intelligence are not reducing jobs as fast as new jobs are being created. What will happen over time? Will we someday reach a situation of much more extensive automation and a much more labor-light economy? We don't know. We might end up there, but we're not there yet. And it's important that we don't run ahead of ourselves with strategies for that situation. We're not there yet. We have urgent tasks and important work to do in filling the jobs that exist today, including good middle-income jobs. And that has to be our strategy. And it means upgrading the skills of every worker and investing in people at different points in their life, not just when they are young. All our systems are too front-loaded to the first 18 or 22 years of a person's life. That's the way it was traditionally, and in the old days you left school and you got a job. It no longer works. We now have what's called the paradox of skills. Employers need people with skills, not just paper qualifications. But every employer will tell you very honestly that skills don't last very long either, because the half-life of technology is now much shorter than it used to be, and the skills you had 10 years ago get depleted very quickly, and you need new skills. That's the nature of the modern economy. But it means we now have to invest in people at regular points of their lives, not just when they're young. And it's a whole new infrastructure, a new form of funding, new partnerships between the state, educational institutions, private training providers, employers, unions, and individuals. And in Singapore, this is our single most important strategy. We call it Skills Future, single most important economic and social strategy, investing in people through their lives. It is also very empowering for individuals. And the way we've done it in Singapore is to give everyone their own learning account for them to decide how to use, quite apart from our working with employers to subsidize training and enable the upgrading of skills for the workplace of the future. We've also given everyone their own learning account, because that too it's empowering, and when you take it together, this continuous learning at the workplace with the ability for you to decide at different points in your life how you refresh yourself, it is itself a democratizing force. It's an empowering force. We have to experiment with new forms of learning for people who are in their careers. It's not a matter of just going off and doing a course in a university or polytechnic and then coming back when you've finished. There's a whole range of options now. Online courses, hybrid courses, flipped classrooms as they call it. But nearness to the job is a very exciting area of learning. I was just in Stuttgart last week, and I was visiting a firm that is one of the leading players in Industry 4.0, and they had in their factory a production line that was just for learning, but that mimicked identically what the real-life production line was about, which was the Internet of Things. Whole new set of skills required. And they're working with apprentices who start off knowing very little, but step by step, everyone can learn and pick up the skills required. step by step. I asked the manager how they actually went about learning, apart from doing it on the job. And he said they'll pull teams of people out, often into their seminar rooms for bites of learning. And I asked him, what is a bite like? Is it 2 weeks? 1 week? How much learning? He said, half an hour. Half an hour and you immediately apply what you've learned. There's an old adage that some of you would know, the Chinese have this adage, I think many other cultures have this adage, what you practice, you remember better. And what you practice immediately, you remember even better. So that's a whole exciting field of learning, bite-sized learning suitable to working adults at the workplace, in the community, and even at home. The partnerships, the social partnerships that were part of traditional social democracy, businesses and unions, themselves need reinvention in this new setting. The traditional bargaining relationship had to do with wages or preservation of jobs. It now has to evolve towards developing the skills of the future in every individual. And that is a far more progressive task. And the social partnership that exists in many parts of Europe, exists in Singapore in what we call a tripartite partnership between government, unions, and businesses, is a real asset. It's a real asset in helping working individuals prepare for the future, quite apart from the regular tasks of wage negotiations and so on. Investing in every individual for the skills of the future. Let me move on now to housing and neighborhoods. Not a conventional topic, but we now know how important it is. There have been excellent studies in the United States by Raj Chetty and his collaborators showing that how you shape up in education and in life depends not just on yourself, not just on your family. There is such a thing as society. We're not just individual men and women. There is such a thing as society. The people you grew up with, the people you meet at the street corner, the people you go to school with. It's a whole set of influences, positive and negative, that shape our aspirations and that allow us to escape what we start from or trap us in what we start from. Neighborhoods matter and housing matters. And I would say this is the one area of public policy that's probably unique in Singapore. Very little else that we do is unique. We borrow, we copy, we adapt. We try to join things up a little better, and we are a small country, so we can do it more effectively, but very little is unique. But I would say our housing and neighborhood strategy is unique. We did it as a matter of necessity. I don't think we realized the extent of social benefits that would be realized over time, but it's now fundamental to the Singapore social and economic model and our identity. And basically, it revolves around helping people own their homes. And Singapore is a home ownership society. In the bottom 20% of people by incomes, 80% own their homes. That's the first factor. How is it possible? We give people a grant coming out of the government budget. 2/3 of young individuals, once they've gotten married, get a grant to buy the house. And for those in the bottom 10%, it's a very substantial grant as a percentage of the cost of the flat. Very substantial grant. And if you think of it in financial terms, it's really a capital endowment that we give every individual. Not a rental subsidy, which is often the case for social housing in the West, where you have to keep subsidizing rental when housing is too expensive, but a one-off capital endowment, and you own your home. It creates a different ethos within the family and in the neighborhood, but it also does something else, which I'll come to in a moment. First strategy, capital endowment. Second strategy is neighborhood design so that everyone is mixed up in the same neighborhood. And in our case, that means socio-economic mixing, everyone from the poorest to the upper middle income group in the same public housing neighborhoods, which, unlike social housing in the West, is really like private condominiums but with no fences and gates. Common property, everything at the ground level is common property. You own your own apartment, but it's otherwise public property. But that mix of people is critical because it's interaction as you go up and down the lift every day. It's about the kindergartens your children go to, because children tend to go to kindergartens quite close to where they live. It's just that ordinary daily interaction that breeds familiarity and a sense of sameness. But critically, we also have a strategy of requiring that every neighborhood is ethnically mixed. And that is our most intrusive social strategy in Singapore. Intrusive constrains choices. It doesn't mean we tell you where to live, but it means that we cap the concentration of any particular ethnic group in every housing block and every neighborhood. We did it because we noticed that people were tending to concentrate with their own ethnic groups in different neighborhoods in the 60s and 70s. And we put in place that policy for that reason. And it's turned out to be critical. Now, coming back to that capital endowment and the fact that we've mixed everyone up, the combination of those two things gives us something very important for free, which is that because we do not have any disadvantaged neighborhoods in Singapore, we've got disadvantaged individuals, we've got disadvantaged families, but we don't have a single disadvantaged neighborhood, literally. Within the neighborhood, as a result, home equity, home prices appreciate at roughly the same rate, from the smallest apartments to the largest. And in fact, over the last 35 years, the smallest apartments have seen a somewhat larger rate of higher rate of appreciation, but that's not the main point. The point is, everyone sees home appreciation at roughly the same rate based on the performance of the overall economy and the avoidance of serious social problems. Every neighborhood is a mixed neighborhood, and we avoid the gulf in wealth, the increasing wealth inequalities that are normally seen in the workings of the market, because poor people usually can't afford their homes. And they may depend on a rental subsidy, or they may take it out of their own income, but they don't accumulate wealth. And we've got that for free, without a constant infusion of resources from the budget, just by urban design, by urban planning, and by mixing people up so that you don't have a disadvantaged neighborhood. That plus the fact that we regularly refresh the neighborhoods, do renovations, do fixing, make sure that broken windows are never left broken. We always avoid the broken window phenomenon. Don't leave a window broken. If the lift is broken, fix it quickly. If power failures happen, 40 minutes, fix it. That too keeps it a neighborhood where people feel this is not a disadvantaged neighborhood. So that's a very important ethos. And it's, I say ethos because it creates a different mood. It's a mood of sameness, a mood of ownership, a mood of inclusivity. Greatly neglected in conventional studies, at least I didn't study it at the LSE, although I did both economics and sociology, but it's turned out to be a critical fact in all our societies. And there are very good studies at the LSE by Professor Lucinda Platt and others on the importance of neighborhoods and ethnic concentrations, quite apart from the studies I mentioned in the US, and in fact there are very important studies in Europe as well. And we all know about the problems of the French banlieues. So spread quality across education, spread quality across our neighborhoods, spread quality across the workforce, and keep investing and reinvesting in people. Finally, economic openness. Topical issue. But it's still fundamental to how we improve our lives. It's fundamental not for reasons of demand, whether domestic demand is more important than external demand, which is the way it's often posed by some of the international institutions and in some of the development literature, That's not the issue. Even if international demand is soft or weak, for any given level of demand, there is a big difference between exporting more and importing more. Same trade deficit, same trade balance, same amount of demand, but you can export more and import more compared to exporting less and importing less and going for import substitution. There is a big difference. We knew it from the Latin American story in the 60s that import substitution doesn't work. And the reasons are twofold. First, the real logic of opening up is not about demand, it's about the supply side. It's about the discipline of constant learning that comes from participating in global markets. And that was the story of the NREs in Asia. It was the story of Japan before us. It was the story of China. Participating in international markets provides that discipline at the micro level within the enterprise, within each team in the enterprise, of constant learning. Far more dynamic. That's what takes productivity up. That's what takes incomes up. Each time a buyer provides a new specification, you've got to adapt, you've got to learn. Each time there's a new technology used by a competitor somewhere else, you want to adopt it as quickly as possible. So is that constant innovation, accumulation of skills, and accumulation not just of explicit knowledge, but tacit knowledge, that is vastly superior in an open economy compared to a closed economy. And that really requires emphasis in today's world, where there's a certain despondency about participating in the global economy and about cooperative internationalism. The ultimate source of economic progress and income growth is productivity growth, and productivity growth in all our economies is superior in the industries and firms that are oriented to the rest of the world. The data is exceptionally clear. Even in the United States, those in exporting firms and industries have significantly higher incomes than those in the domestic sector. And it's not just level of incomes, it's growth of incomes. So the logic of opening up is a supply-side logic. It's a logic of constant learning, constant upgrading, and that's what really lifts incomes. And I really have to emphasize that because that debate is still not settled in a whole range of developing countries, and it is now under question in a range of advanced countries. So let me conclude by returning to the whole issue of how we reimagine the public good and how we revitalize the politics of the broad center, be it center left or center right. The status quo is not going to bring back inclusive growth, and it's not going to bring back a sense of togetherness in society. We need activist states, but activist states that are focused on what matters most in providing individuals with hope and enabling them to earn their own success. And it means a new compact between collective responsibility and individual responsibility. The traditional solutions of the right were to emphasize self-reliance and individual responsibility. There is no such thing as society. The traditional solutions of the left were to treat collective responsibility as a matter of redistribution. And what we really need now is to build a compact of collective and individual responsibility. Collective responsibility reinforcing personal and family responsibility. If you're going to put in effort in school, I'm going to help you more. If you want to own a home, I'm going to help you own a home. If you're going to get a job, I'll give you a tax credit if you're low paid to help you stay on in the job. If you want to upgrade your skills, I'm going to subsidize it very heavily. When I say I'm referring to the collective. In some ways, it takes us back to where social democracy started, and indeed the social market economy of the center-right started. It was always about individual effort, hard work, thrift, responsibility for the family, but it was also about collective support so that we are protected from the vagaries of life. but the core values were always about personal and family responsibility. And it's on that foundation that we now need a lot more activism on the part of the state and partnerships between the state, civil society, business enterprises, unions, and a range of other groups of individuals to breathe life into this new compact. Left on their own, individuals will find it hard to cope and to erase the deficits that they start with, the disadvantages of life that many people start with. If we stick purely to a redistributive model, it's not going to offer hope. We'll see more of the same, and the true hope comes from enabling individuals to develop their capabilities to the maximum, and as much as possible to reduce the disadvantages that we start off with. And that is, I feel, the spirit that has to pervade our politics. Help those who start with less to achieve the most in life, and help everyone to contribute to the public good through their own abilities and effort. That is a truly inclusive society. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tharman. It is deeply analytical and also deeply inspirational. So thank you so much. Now, we have just under 20 minutes for questions. Could you please keep your questions very short? Could you please identify yourself when you begin your question? We'll try to get students involved in questions, and there's an LSC tradition of gender balance in questions as well. So those are the ground rules. Now, let's be quick because we've only got 20 minutes and we want to and fro with Tharman as much as we possibly can. I'm going to take three at a time, okay?
Yes, my name is David Marsh. You spoke about the societal shifts which clearly contributed to Mr. Trump's election. How well do you think Trump's America will be in navigating these social and cultural shoals that you spoke about?
So we'll take two more. There's a lady at the back there, just there. This lady with her hand up just there, just next to you. Thank you.
I'm interested in fostering a sense of close...
Your name, please.
I'm Chin Yi. I'm studying geography at UCL. I'm interested in what you talked about for neighbourhoods, because I see that in Singapore, we already have neighbourhoods with a strong sense of identity. So how can a government actually cope against the rising sense of not in my backyard, where people reject changes that sort of threaten their feelings of prosperity within a neighbourhood, when we try to cater for people who may be marginalised in such a mixed community of different levels of prosperity, so as in providing for the old or the disadvantaged? And then second question, very quickly, is...
It better be quick, this
yeah,
one.
Yeah, it's very quick. So do you think that the narrative of inclusive community should be extended to cases of private residential neighbourhoods such as those in Singapore? And in a case where political provisions does not allow that to be done, how do you think we can still include them in what you have talked about?
Thank you. One down here, and then I'll try to move out to the wings. The gentleman right at the front here.
Thank you. Gerard Lyons, I'm an economist. Thanks for a fantastic speech. In one area you didn't really mention was the financial sector. If one looks at the factors that have driven down wages or suppressed wages, you touched on three of the four: relationship between workers, managers, financial technology, and globalization. But in the UK, as well as in Singapore, we have big financial sectors, and many of the problems you've touched on have coincided with the growth of the financial sector. What's your solution or feeling about the role the financial sector has played in the problems of the past, and how can it provide a solution to the future? Thanks.
Thank you. Tharman, please.
Well, three very good questions. You had to start with Trump. Let's put it this way. If we leave aside the noise of campaign promises and some, you know, early actions that appear to be efforts to stay close to those promises, any U.S. administration, including this one, will seek to create jobs in a sustainable way. And I believe, based on all the evidence we have, not just as a matter of political priors, but on the basis of all the evidence, that to create jobs, you have to create communities of learning in the towns that are most affected. You have to raise productivity, and you need a fair sharing of productivity gains. That's central. All the rest is really rearranging the furniture. The basic story of economic development in developing countries and advancing people's lives in advanced countries is that of learning, collaboration, improvements in productivity, and fair sharing of productivity gains. And there's tremendous scope for doing that in the U.S. And there are very good examples of it. I just visited a few months ago a community college in Northern Virginia, one of the more successful ones, in my opinion. I've visited several of them. Thick relationships with local employers, not as thick as the Germans, but constant interaction between the needs of the job, the curriculum and the courses, the equipment being contributed by private employers so that students learn using the same equipment that's out there in the market. But it's those thick relationships that matter. Communities of learning are what will get you better jobs and better quality jobs for the future. And the story of the open economy and cooperative internationalism that makes it possible for everyone to gain from it is still a powerful story. We do gain from specialization, but if we ignore those who have lost out because of globalization, the whole game gets threatened. And that has been a central lesson of the last several years. It's not just about Trump, not just about Brexit. Problems were allowed to fester, and the costs of globalization were highly localized. They were highly localized. The benefits are broadly felt, lower prices of consumer products, in general, a growth of jobs, which has been the case in the United States, the growth of jobs. But the costs and those who lose out tend to be concentrated in certain towns and cities, and they were neglected. And that has to be addressed. The question at the top about the NIMBY phenomenon, not in my backyard, and private residential estates is a very good one. I think in Singapore what we've done is to design housing estates such that private residential living, be it landed apartments or condominiums, are as close as possible to our public housing estates. There are a few very exclusive neighborhoods which are not so close, but it's a small island. You're just a few underground stops from each other, basically. In my own constituency, which is very typical, I'm in Taman Jurong, close to the industrial heartland of Singapore. First, to illustrate the point I made earlier about mixing and proximity and daily interaction, the distance from my poorest households, which are in a set of rental blocks, to the upper middle income in the public housing estates, which are what we call five-room apartments and executive apartments, in my constituency is about 100 meters. And the distance to the private residential apartments, landed and condominium, in my constituency is another 50 meters or 80 meters. Same bus stops, same MRT station, same hawker center, same atrocious way of dressing every weekend. There's a sameness about us. So urban planning is critical. Urban planning is not about utilities, it's not about transport, it is social urban planning. It's about how you maximize the scope for people to interact without having to force them to do so. Financial sector, I think you have a point. I think we've gone through a phase of over-financialization of many economies. Good for financial centers, but I think economies at large have seen a significant increase in inequality, in part because of the role of the financial center. The good news is I think the cycle is turning. We are going to see technology taking over a significant part of financial jobs in the middle office and back office, including managerial jobs. And second, I think there's now a light being shone on the financial sector the way there wasn't during that market fundamentalist era. So you will have an elite in every society. You will have some people who are doing much better than others, and the financial sector is one area where they work. But I think we've seen the most of what happened, and the cycle is turning.
Thank you. There's a lady just here, and then there's a lady over there.
Lady. Thank you very much for the excellent talk. My name is Leah Lucas. I'm studying an MSc in African development. So you discussed many examples from areas of the world, from Latin America to India. I'm interested in maybe honing in on the area of Africa. The development of African countries, we see a large difference in the development of Singapore, other NIC countries, in that Africa is very rich in natural resources, which we have unfortunately seen a resource curse in many countries. So instead of this increases in labor productivity and increases in development of human capital, many African countries have unfortunately dealt with some issues with the large natural resource wealth. So do you have any advice or lessons that African countries can learn to have a more inclusive form of development and prosperity? Thank you.
Thank you. And there's a lady, just a couple rows down, a lady in the dark shirt there.
My name is Badra, and I'm a second-year LSE student. I wanted to ask your opinion on multiculturalism and how it has fared in Singapore.
Hi, my name is Shafiq Shahidzadeh. My question is, since March 2006...
You want to put your little closer to the mic?
Hi. Since March 2006, when Singapore and Iran signed a bilateral investment treaty, how do you see the journey of economic collaboration between the two countries, considering the new US administration extending Iran sanctions? Thank you.
Thanks. The first question is a very important one, which is a perennial issue in development economics, and that's the resource curse. It used to be called the Dutch disease. It is one where some lessons have been learnt over time. First, for a country that is fortunate to have a significant resource endowment, either black fluid that comes up from under the ground or something else, it is important to take an intergenerational view. Norway is a good example of how they put the proceeds of their oil revenues into a national endowment fund, part of the reserves, and there are then rules on how much you draw on it each year. It does two things. First, it conserves that benefit of endowment for perpetuity, which is far more equitable to your children and grandchildren's generation. Second, it then makes transparent how the revenues are being used on the government budget. The traditional approach is actually one where some individuals and businesses capture a lot of the rent, and it's not well distributed. So you'll find typically that countries that are resource rich are also highly unequal. So from the perspective of governance, this strategy of putting things away in a financial endowment and making it transparent as to how it's used on the budget has several benefits. But governance is critical, politics is critical, and I think Africa today is in a better place than it was 10 or 15 years ago in terms of the evolution of its democracies. There's some very good success stories in strengthening of governance, but that is still the central challenge. Multiculturalism in Singapore, apart from what I said earlier, and for Singapore this was existential. And it's because it was an existential issue that we put in place the guardrails, put in place the urban planning policies to integrate people early on, and put in place a school system that brought together different language streams into a common public school system. But we have avoided, let's put it this way, we have avoided the disaster seen in a whole range of other societies that gained independence from the colonial powers, whether it be British or other colonial powers. We've avoided some of the very stark problems. And if I compare amongst the ex-British colonies, Singapore avoided what Sri Lanka went through. It's avoided what even Mauritius, which is a relatively peaceful society, still today has a very divided population. But that's not good enough. The fact that we've had peaceful coexistence and people don't feel threatened by each other is a very useful foundation for Singapore, but we have to deepen our multiculturalism for the future. First, because it is good for everyone, it strengthens our national identity. Second, because it is going to be a very troubled world. And deepening our multiculturalism means not just the rules set by the state, not just the structures of the school system and housing neighborhoods. It means interaction and friendships that have to be built from young. And I think Singapore still has that potential to develop a richer form of multiculturalism that is personal. It is the way we remember our youth, the friends we had, and it's about curiosity in different cultures and taking pride in them, not because it might be part of a social studies examination, but because that's what makes life interesting in Singapore. It's a blessing. So I think we really have that opportunity. Iran, I don't have much to say about it. We have a good relationship with Iran. We ensure that we abide very strictly by the UN Security Council sanctions. We are very strict about it, but there's a way in which you keep your relationship alive and don't try to snuff out every form of contact or business. And Singapore, as a small country, has to be a steady partner for all our partners. We can't swing with the winds too easily. We have to be a steady partner, abide by international rules, but otherwise keep our links and keep our relationship.
Thank you very much, Darman. Now, I'm sorry that we've come to the end of our time. It was such an inspirational talk, Darman, that there are many people who would like to ask questions. But it's my job to... I'm sorry, the questions are over. It's my job to thank you, Darman. It's one thing to be anxious about the world and its problems and to recognize that we are in a very difficult place. It's one thing to have a hunger for something to do about that. It's another thing to provide us with a clear, thoughtful story about what to do. And that's what you gave us tonight. You brought the reason of your analysis, the evidence that was critical, a knowledge of research, including research at the LSE and our collaborators. And you brought reason to that evidence, so evidence, reason, and values. That's the essence of the Enlightenment, but I think it's also the essence of the LSE, understanding the causes of things, but also bringing real analysis to the policy as well as the problem. We've learnt enormously tonight, Tarman. We're enormously in your debt. And I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to ask you to thank Tarman in two ways. Now, the first way is to let Tarman leave the room whilst you are in your seats so that he can get out without being mobbed. That would be really appreciated by us at the LSE and I'm sure by the Deputy Prime Minister of Singapore. But the second way is in the normal manner.